Hello and welcome to
Sci-Fi.
So today's episode is an interview with Matt Ruff, author of, among other things, Lovecraft Country. Kevin couldn't join us for this episode because he is not a real person, only we can see him.
Shh, don't tell them.
So without further ado, here is our interview with Matt Ruff. Matt Ruff, welcome to Sci-Fi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing quite fine, thank you.
We wanted to wish you, by the way, a belated happy birthday.
Yes, happy birthday.
Yes, I'm an old man of 51. Yeah, which is hard to believe, but means I've been published for going on 30 years now.
So it's terrifying.
It's means I'm actually going to grow old and die and probably not too long from now.
Yeah. I certainly
so on
hope
that
not.
Cheery note.
Yes. Then we should start out perhaps in younger days. Your first novel, Fool on the Hill, was based on your Cornell experience, if I'm not tremendously badly mistaken, and have been somehow reading this book upside down.
Yeah, I'd been writing since I was 5 years old, and I got to Cornell, and I was reaching the point where I was going to have to start paying for my own food. And so it was time to write a novel that I could actually sell. And I had a bunch of different story ideas, you know, one about a college of talking animals, one about these sort of borrower type little people living in the walls of the university, and a couple of other storylines on top of that. And none of them quite worked as a novel on their own. So I got this idea to just sort of throw them all together with a framing story about a Greek god who likes to mess around with people's lives. And it was one of those ideas that really shouldn't have worked, but it turns out I have a knack for juggling multiple storylines, so it kind of did. And one of my creative writing teachers was Allison Lurie, and she liked the novel and set me up with her agent, and so I got published right out of school and never looked back.
So my brother actually went to Cornell, class of 90, so I actually visited Cornell possibly while you were still there. I don't remember the precise year.
And I think I would have been gone by then, but you almost caught me.
Almost, yeah. I think there's something about Cornell that creates a lot of lore about it that I don't necessarily see in every other campus. For example, I was wondering immediately once I started reading the book, okay, is he going to talk about the two statues that will shake hands if
a virgin walks between them at midnight? Yeah.
Yes.
The campus becomes a character in the novel, and that was a part of the reason I set it there. It was sort of my love letter to Cornell, and it was also, you know, a neat bit of branding because I figured if nothing else, the book will always stay in print at Cornell. But yeah, this is how impractical my college choice was. It was basically like I visited Cornell and fell in love with the campus. I didn't really think too much about offer courses in every study, but I was less interested in the academics at first, and just it looked like a really cool place to spend 4 years of my life. You know, after spending an hour messing around the campus and seeing the gorges that cut through it and it's just beautiful geography and a beautiful old storied place. And So I fell in love with it right away. And of course, that's actually a really stupid reason to choose a particular school. But then again, you know, taking creative writing isn't exactly bright either. So I have just been very fortunate that these sort of goofy decisions kind of worked out for me.
Yeah, as a fellow English major, I'm totally on board.
Yeah. Well, I guess there are more options today now than there were just for creative people who don't really have any salable skills other than their creativity. And who don't want to teach.
Yeah, that was sort of a problem for me as well. But you took the route that actually used your education, so congratulations on that.
Well, thank you.
In the book, of course, Stephen George is asked where he gets his crazy ideas from, and he replies that he has roses delivered to him and that he smells them, and that stimulates something called the Dinsmore lobe of his brain. So I Googled the Dinsmore lobe, being a neuro geek, and I was pointed back to a children's novel character called Elsie Dinsmore and a novel called Fool on the Hill, which left me with no questions about that weren't completely insane. So is it good to be a writer?
Yeah, it is. It's funny. I only remember that bit about the Dinsmore lobe because I had to reread Fool on the Hill recently for editing the ebook edition. And yeah, I don't know what the joke was supposed to be there anymore. Like, I'm sure Dinsmore actually referred to something, like maybe, I don't know, but I have no idea where that name came from anymore. It's one of those things that's lost in the mists of time. So I don't remember.
We prefer to think of Theo's as perfect inside jokes.
Yeah. Well, that was sort of my thing when I was younger. There was maybe a little too many inside jokes. I think I've reeled that wackiness in a little bit more as I've gotten older, but I'm still glad that the younger me is on record somewhere.
Is there anything else you wanted to say about Fool on the Hill before we move on?
No, only it's just, I'm glad it's still in print and it captured that time of my life really nicely. There was a long while when going back and rereading, it was like looking at an old high school yearbook. On the one hand, you're nostalgic. On the other hand, you keep going, why did I think that was a cool haircut? But as I wrote recently, I think I've sort of come out the far side now where I can appreciate it completely on its own terms. And it actually still holds up for me. And I'm glad that people are still discovering it and still enjoying it.
Oh, Barry, there was, I think, a bit of fiction he wrote in college you wanted to talk about.
This novella was conceived in sin. We were reading about that on your website.
Yeah, that was sort of an extended dirty joke I read in Allison Lurie's class. I think there were some of my classmates just I don't know, they had a problem with some other story I wrote. They felt that something about it was offensive. So I think I decided to write something that would be really, really offensive. And God, I don't even remember many of the details about it anymore. But it was one of those things where it was like part one of what would have been a very offensive two-part story. But, you know, I sort of got tired of it after the first part, because just being offensive is only fun for a while. And you've actually got to have a cool story to go with it. So I let it go after that. You can read more about it. I think I wrote a little bit more about it on my website about what it actually entailed. But
yeah, that was something that I was reading. I was actually going to ask about part two, but it sounds like it's not going to happen.
No, I'd have to go back and like remember what the hell was in it to even figure out what was going to happen in back two. But that's one of those things that it's probably just as well I didn't finish it, and that it's in my juvenilia, my lost juvenilia.
Yeah, Barry heard about this and says, I like this guy. So
it kind of reminds me of something that I might possibly do if I was being, you know, accused of being not politically correct enough or something.
I know, but it's one of those things, too. I bet if I went back and read it, it probably wouldn't be nearly as funny as I thought it was at the time. So, again, just as well, it's lost in the mists of time.
Yeah, so many jokes are of their time.
So there was also an Aliens movie that you produced and acted in.
Yeah, continuing my totally impractical education, I took film for one semester. Our teacher was Marilyn Ripchin, and my final film was a parody of Aliens called Risleyans. Risley was the dorm where I lived, and it was the performing arts dorm, theme dorm, basically. And so we were the gay dorm, basically, and at a time when that was still a really derogatory thing to say. And so I decided to do a parody of Risleyans where the Colonial Marines get sent in to wipe out the theater arts dorm. And we filmed a lot in the sort of steam tunnels down in the basement of the building. And it was a crude but effective special effects. And I actually still have an almost 30-year-old videotape of that, which I, thank goodness, got transferred to DVD by Vonda McIntyre, who's a writer here in Seattle. And she had the equipment to do that. And one of these days, if I can figure out how to transfer it to YouTube, I think I should upload it, but I haven't got around to it yet.
We support this idea.
I'm sure you do. And you can see photo outtakes anyway on my website. I've got some pictures, still frames from the show that show some of the really state-of-the-art special effects from 1987. So,
what was the budget for the movie?
I probably spent about 50 or 60 bucks and, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Big budget for that kind of production, I think.
Most of that was probably just developing a few reels of film, and then, yeah, there was plastic vampire teeth and a couple of other things we used, but that was about it.
Awesome. So did you want to talk about Bad Monkeys?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay, so Bad Monkeys is my fourth novel. After I finished my third novel, Set This House in Order, I came up with this idea for what I thought was going to be this very small little gem of a story that I didn't think anyone, you know, it would be cool to do, but I didn't think it was necessarily going to be a big deal. And of course, it ended up being my most commercially successful book to date. And it's my Philip K. Dick novel. And it's about a woman named Jane Charlotte who's arrested for murder and basically tells the police that she works for a secret organization that fights evil. And her division, the nickname of her division within the organization is Bad Monkeys. And basically, they're the guys who go out and kill the hit squad that go out and kill, like, the worst people in the world. That Bad Monkeys is a euphemism for really evil men. The cops pitch her to a psychiatrist, and then the question is Jane lying? Is she really crazy? Or is there something else going on here? And that's the bare bones of the story. And it starts out kind of weird, and it gets weirder and weirder as it goes along, but it ultimately does all make sense, I hope. and this was a book that actually started out as just a title. The title Bad Monkeys comes from a South Park episode where the South Park kids go to the Costa Rican rainforest, and at one point Cartman
oh my
is hitting a monkey with a stick, and he's screaming, "Bad monkey, you know, bad." And I'm watching that, and I heard that, and I was just like, geez, Bad Monkeys. It sounds like that would be a good title for a novel. I wonder what it would be about. And
has that ever happened to you before, having the title first?
It's happened a couple of times. My second novel, Sewer Gas and Electric, was the same thing, where it was a day when I was supposed to be working on Fool in the Hill, and instead I was putzing around at the Cornell bookstore, and looking at all the Tolkien ripoffs, and I started thinking about what would be the weirdest name for a trilogy that might actually be a reasonably good story. And so I came up with Sewer Gas and Electric, and only later figured out what it was about. And that story too can be found on my website. But yeah, so with Bad Monkeys, I came up with a couple of different ideas. One was a fairly realistic procedural where Bad Monkeys was a euphemism for especially bad criminals. The other one was a science fiction cop drama where Bad Monkeys was the name of the division of the police department that pursued human criminals, as opposed to the Bad Robots division, which went after evil AIs, and the Bad Martians division that went after
J.J. Abrams.
Evil aliens. Yeah. And so the cop drama thing didn't quite work, but I liked the idea of having all these different departments with cool little nicknames. And so I turned the science fictional police department into a secret society and then possibly a schizoid delusion. And that's kind of how I got into the novel as it actually is. And there were a few more twists after that, but that's sort of how it works with me.
Did you start out by thinking, oh, this would be perfect to do a Philip K. Dick style novel? Or did you just come up with that third twist and think, and this is a Philip K. Dick novel?
There was a point when I was talking to my wife about it, and I began describing it as my Philip K. Dick novel because it was the kind of thing that, you know, he would write.
Right.
For a long time, I didn't know if the protagonist would be a man or a woman. It could have gone either way. And I thought about having it be a guy and naming him Phil. But then I think one day I was reading a biography of Philip K. Dick, and I found out that he had a twin sister, Jane Charlotte, who died at infancy. And this dead sister sort of haunted him his whole life. And so there are coded references to Jane Charlotte in some of his novels. So as soon as I read that, I'm like, oh, okay. This is going to be not Shakespeare, but Shakespeare's sister. So the novel is about a woman named Jane Charlotte. And a big part of the plot is that she's got a brother, Phil, who may or may not be a ghost. And so again, I don't want to spoil any more of it, but that was sort of how that came into being. And you could see that, as with Fool on the Hill, the way I tend to work is I start connecting things that a normal person probably wouldn't think to connect, and hopefully manage to make it work in a way that's actually entertaining. So
are you ever surprised by how easy it is to connect things? Sometimes, like myself and a friend of mine tried to write one of these secret agency that's ruling everything kind of books, and we actually found ourselves kind of scared. There were so many apparent connections that we had never noticed before until you start looking at the world that way.
Well, I think it was always easy to do that kind of thing, although you have to be the kind of person who likes that kind of play. It's like solving a logic puzzle or a crossword puzzle. But yeah, and of course today with Google makes it much easier to hunt up obscure references that you can then tie together. So I think if anything, it's gotten simpler than it was. Of course, what this means is in real life, I tend to be a pretty hard-headed skeptic because I know how easy it is to come up with this stuff and suspend your own disbelief about it. So it's like, just because it sounds weird and crazy has nothing to do with whether it's likely to be true.
So then I take it you never saw the ghost in the dorm room that you lived in at Cornell?
No, what ghost? Oh, was there supposed to be a ghost at Risley? That's a story I've forgotten.
Well, Wikipedia claims it's haunted, and I mean, Wikipedia could not be wrong.
It's on the internet. It has to be true.
You know, that might very well be a thing, but I don't recall having ever encountered a ghost there. So I saw a lot of other strange stuff, but most of it was just my friends. So,
all right. So do you do a lot of location research? Barry was noticing when he was reading through Bad Monkeys that
there were some fairly, what seemed to be specific, you know, places in San Francisco in the Bay Area, you know, if not, you know, very close to it.
Right. We're Bay Area, so we tend to pick up on that sort of thing. You got the geography right is the point.
I tend to be a nerd about getting geography right, or at least trying to get it wrong deliberately rather than you know, oh, I didn't even bother to look at that. And basically, I at some point during the writing, I decide what level of realism I'm going for and where it's okay to depart from that. And this sometimes bites me in the ass in the final copy editing process, because I'll realize that I've put something in and I don't know whether it's true or not. And the problem isn't that it might not be true. It's just that if it's not true, I want to have made a deliberate decision to have it not be true. And I think that there was a moment towards the end of Bad Monkeys, yeah, there was some, I think it was Panhandle Park, there's a reference to that, or the Panhandle, where Jane is sitting under a statue, and it occurred to me that I'd never checked whether there was a statue in the park. And my wife was like, what does it matter? You could just put one there. And I'm like, I know I could just put one there, but if I was going to make it up, I want to know that I was making it up. And she's like, yeah, okay. If you're thinking like this and you're almost done, because you've gotten finished thinking about all the things that are important to think about. But the answer to the larger question is, it will depend. If I can spend time wandering around an area that I'm going to write about, I will often do that. Sometimes it's just procrastinating, but occasionally sure. I do actually, if I'm going to have an action scene, I like to be able to sort of block out what it's going to look like. Almost as if I were going to film there, I will walk around and see, does it really make sense to describe this happening this way? And again, you know, sometimes you have to bend reality a little bit to allow it to do what you want it to do, but I like to be deliberate about it. But
right. Maybe just fix reality a little
just
bit.
Just fix it. Now, of course, a lot of times you can't visit places. My fifth novel, The Mirage, is set in Baghdad for the most part. So there it was, Google Earth is very useful for visiting parts of the world that you, first of all, couldn't legally go to anyway, and you'd be taking your life in your hands to do that. So yeah, Google Earth and Google Maps and Google Street View has made it much easier to do this sort of thing, to just sort of satisfy your curiosity in most cases.
Of course, your latest novel is Lovecraft Country. That's kind of how we discovered you, so to speak. So how did you first discover Lovecraft?
Oh, I think I must have started reading him when I was very young. I mean, he's just one of those guys who's on the list you'll eventually encounter. And I think when I was younger, he was one of those writers who I didn't like his writing as much as I liked his imitators.
Right.
And that may have been how I discovered him. I may have seen either films or read other stories by people imitating him and then, you know, worked backwards to find him. Like, I don't remember a first encounter. And then as I've gotten older, I've come to appreciate him more for himself. And I still like some of his imitators and some of his subverters. I'm not the only one sort of turning certain elements of Lovecraft on its head, but I still like a lot of his work. So
of course, that's also tied closely with civil rights and race relations. Was that something you'd ever like deliberately studied in the past?
I took some Africana studies courses at Cornell. I had a friend of mine named Joe Scantlebury. He was the residence housing director at Ujamaa at Cornell. And he was not the first black friend I had ever had, but he was the first one who sort of made a conscious effort to get me to see the ways in which his life was sort of fundamentally different from mine. And the first one who got me to listen. Mm-hmm. And so through him, I ended up taking a couple of courses in Africana studies. And the professor I remember was a guy named James Turner, he's just one of those teachers. If you make a short list of, you know, three or four teachers who've left a lasting mark on you, he would be one of them. So stuff I talked about with them and stuff I learned about in Professor Turner's class sort of stayed with me, and I've been thinking about it for a long while. And it showed up in my other novels as well. But the way I got to Lovecraft Country, it was originally a TV series pitch. And What I wanted to do basically was The X-Files, or a show like The X-Files. But the idea was that instead of having two white FBI agents, the protagonist was a field researcher for a black travel guide from the 1950s. And during the era of legal segregation, there were these guidebooks. The most famous one was called the Green Book. Mm-hmm. That would list hotels and restaurants and other accommodations across the country where black people could go, that would accept black customers, basically. Because in those days, even in the North and the West, you just couldn't assume you would be served most places. And in some ways, it was actually more difficult out, you know, in the North and West, because in the South, you had signs telling you where you could go, which wasn't very many places, and where you couldn't go, which was most of it. In the North and the far West, you didn't have signs. There was just as much segregation, though. So in addition to being discriminated against, there was this guessing game where you never knew what you were going to get. And it could, at best, be really humiliating and frustrating. And at worst, it could be very dangerous if you stopped at the wrong place and the people who ran it felt threatened or what have you. So there were these guidebooks that would list places that were open to black customers. And it became indispensable. So I thought I would make my Fox Mulder character a field researcher, somebody whose job was to drive around the country looking for establishments that would serve him. And he would also be a, you know, a science fiction and fantasy nerd, and somebody who, if he saw a flying saucer set down in a field, would be intrigued rather than frightened. But the real explanation for why he kept running into monsters all the time was that he was a black man in America. And when you're a black man in America, there's always a monster. You know, sometimes it's the Lovecraftian elder gods, but sometimes it's the state police or the Klan or the registrar of voters, you know. And I thought it would just be an interesting setting to sort of have combine that, take these old-fashioned paranormal stories, but breathe new life into them by seeing how they change when you... when you made the star a black man living, particularly in that period of history. My TV pitch didn't go anywhere. It was probably a little too early for that, but the idea stayed with me, and so I decided to figure out a way to turn it into a novel. And so the book is a little more concentrated in and around Chicago. Like Atticus, my protagonist, still gets that job, but most of the action takes place in Chicago, and it involves not just him, but his extended family. His Uncle George, who is the owner of a travel agency and the publisher of what I call the Safe Negro Travel Guide. Atticus's father, who is still kind of mad at him for joining the army and going to fight in Korea because he doesn't see why he wants to get killed for a country that doesn't want to respect him. And his aunt Hippolyta, who also works at the travel agency, but her dream is she wishes she could have been an astronomer, which was, of course, not a career really open to black women at that time. And his childhood friend Letitia, who buys a house in a white neighborhood that turns out to be haunted. And so all of these characters, every chapter of the book is sort of a mini adventure. Like, so it's a combination of the X-Files monster of the week. And then it also is part of a larger arc story about Atticus and some very unusual family relations he has back in New England. And that's sort of the basic setup. And I'm very happy with the way it turned out, and I guess you guys liked it too. So,
yeah, we thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yes, one of the things we liked about it was the fact that you had all of the characters be genre savvy. They knew what was likely to happen in stories like this, and they actually seemed to have an understanding on some level that they were in that kind of story, or at least could recognize it when they were entering that kind of story. And that was just a lot of fun, because one of the things that drives me nuts so much is when you don't feel like the characters are quite acting the way that you would act in the scenario, because I'm afraid that, you know, I'm the sort of person that kind of assumes that I'm walking into a novel whenever I get into a weird situation, which is probably not a good habit, but...
No, but I prefer stories where the characters act realistically, and like you still occasionally will see zombie stories where people act as if they'd never seen a zombie movie, and I just don't believe that there's anyone who hasn't seen one yet. If you have to be told to shoot for the head, I mean, I have no hope for you. I think characters are more interesting when they're psychologically realistic.
Yeah.
Another part of that puzzle solving is that this is an issue with horror stories, is that you'll come up at points where you need the character to do something, and you know why you want them to do it, but you also realize that a normal person would never choose to do this crazy thing, like, you know, go down into the basement without a flashlight, or on the X-Files, you know, Mulder and Scully were forever only using flashlights in rooms that had overhead lighting. And it's like, why don't you turn the overhead lights on so you can see? Why are you carrying the flashlight?
Why don't you bring in floodlights? Just turn off the darkness completely.
Or why is it you're doing the autopsy in the dark?
Yeah.
So I like to have my characters do things for reasons that make sense. And even if I have to have them do something stupid, I want it to be something where you would see as the reader, it's like, yeah, that's dumb, but they've got no choice. And in a way, this was one aspect where the historical setting and the racism that these folks were up against actually helped with that, because in a lot of cases, they just didn't have as many options as a white character in their situation might. Like, like when Letitia gets this windfall and she decides she wants to buy a house, and to get a nice house, that means she's got to buy a house in a white neighborhood. And she gets a deal that is too good to be true. And so it's no big surprise that the reason it's too good to be true is that the house is haunted. Where a character with more options might decide, well, I'm not going to live in a haunted house, and I'm definitely not going to live in a haunted house surrounded by neighbors who don't want me here either. But the thing with Letitia is, like, the way the financing works, first of all, she can't get her money back. And second, it's like she's never going to get another option. It's not like she can just buy a house anywhere. It's like it's either this or nothing. So she's got to make the best of it. And the wonder of it is that she actually does. So, but yes, I definitely prefer it when the characters act the way you would if you, a genre-savvy person, were trapped in one of these stories.
Myself and my co-hosts are all engineers, and so whenever we start reading fantasy or magical realist or whatever novels, we're always sort of looking at how the magic system is constructed and how it's all put together. Do you have any rules that you use for magic, or is there something that makes magic satisfying or not satisfying in a book?
For me, the rule is I like stuff to make sense. I don't have to know what the rule is, but I have to believe that there is a rule.
Got it.
And I mean, I can certainly see the idea of magic systems where it works differently for each person. That could be kind of interesting, where one story idea that I never got around to writing, but I thought would be cool, would be to have a story where you had different characters from different science fiction stories sort of thrown together with different laws of physics. Like you'd take one, you'd have one from a Jules Verne story and then one from a William Gibson story and maybe one from a Robert Heinlein story. And you would, you know, in some ways they would have different genre conventions, where Jules Verne, he actually had people, like, you know, walking around in space with coats on and stuff like that. And, you know, you'd have the William Gibson guy going, how are they doing that without oxygen tanks? It's just... So I could see sort of crossing that kind of thing where different people are following different laws of physics, but I do like there to be an underlying logic, even if I never convey it to the reader. And I start to get annoyed when I realize that there is no possible explanation that could make the story make sense, unless it's really good.
Right.
Like there's a kind of really good storytelling where you're like, this is totally ridiculous, but I don't care. But a lot of the time, and this happens a lot with long-running TV shows, you reach a point where there have been so many reversals and twists and turns, and at some point the light goes on and you're like, these guys are just pulling it out of their butts, and there's just no way that this could make sense. And that's awesome. When I tend to lose interest. So yeah, with magic, I do like to have a rule, even if I don't tell you.
Excellent. Perfect answer. Were you ever involved in role-playing games or gaming?
Oh yeah, I got into D&D early, and I liked being the dungeon master, so... Haven't done that in a long, long time. These days I'll play World of Warcraft, but that's less about role playing and more about obsessive compulsive treasure collecting.
Yeah, we were wondering that. There's a number of references that made us think about that. In particular, in Bad Monkeys, there was a reference to the Lawful Good Press or something.
Sort of a D&D pun, but it's changed since 9/11, but there really were these sort of rogue publishing companies that would make a point of publishing books that nobody else would touch, like the Anarchist Cookbook and, you know, other bomb-making manuals and stuff like that. The most famous one was probably Loom Panics, which was based, I think, in Washington State, but there was another one called Paladin Press. So I think Lawful Good Press was sort of a play on that for the three other people in the world who remember Paladin Press, who I don't know if they went bankrupt or got sued out or existence or just decided to close down after 9/11 because they realized that the time when you could publish anything you wanted had probably passed.
We're still playing RPGs on a weekly basis or biweekly basis, and I see some of the characters be put in kind of remind me of sort of like the humor level or that comes about from the game garage, so to speak. In particular, there was a scene where in Bad Monkeys where Jane is told to, you know, wait at the grocery store and someone will show up and you're going to get in the car. And she's like, well, what kind of car? She's like, well, you know, the car's going to arrive and you're going to get in it and drive. You know, sort of.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
It was something that I deeply appreciated because it seems so familiar and it was funny.
Yeah, I mean, again, I haven't played in a long time, but I think that way of thinking feeds into storytelling and stays with you forever. So, yes, I'm marked forever by Gary Gygax. And the...
Perfect. I'm seeing Lovecraft Country on lists for the Hugos coming up next
really?
Year.
Oh, that's nice to hear. I had not heard that.
I'm afraid that I'm not an official source, and nor is there any official source right now. I'm just sort of looking at top-rated books that would be eligible right now. Have you gone to science fiction conventions? Is that something that you do?
I have done. I haven't been to one in a while, but yes, I've gone to science fiction conventions plenty of times in the past and will again. The past few years, I've been busy writing Lovecraft Country, so I hadn't got out of the house much. And
There is that writing thing, yes.
There is that whole writing thing, so... But yeah, I'm sure that I will get to WorldCon again one of these days. And there are local conventions that I'll be going to, too.
Well, it is coming to San Jose in 2018.
Yeah, where is it next year?
Finland.
Yeah, I probably won't go to that one. Unless I'm nominated for Hugo. Who knows? Maybe I'll go then.
We'll do our best, which may not be much, but we'll see. So what are you working on now?
So at this point, I'm at that point where you really should decide what to work on next, and I haven't quite figured it out, but I'm generally not a fan of sequels because I feel like if the book is done properly, you will use up the idea that gave birth to it. But Lovecraft Country may be an exception, and I feel like I have more to say with these characters, and the feedback I'm getting from readers is that they would probably like to see more from these characters too. So once I've had time to think it through, I think I will try pitching HarperCollins on doing a Lovecraft Country sequel. And I will keep my fingers crossed that I get to do that. I think that would be my first choice right now. And if not, I've got a couple of half-baked other science fiction ideas that might work out, but they need a little more baking time.
Excellent. Now I want to see what it would have been like as a television show.
I would like to see that too. So we'll see. The book is a good proof of concept. So we'll see if there's an announcement about that sometime.
Excellent. Anything else?
No, I think you covered it, guys. And thank you very much for having me. This was fun.
Oh, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Yes, thank you very much.